This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll visit with Dr. Fred Cerise, former health secretary for the great state of Louisiana. Last year, he was upended in his job. He works at LSU for 20 years, and he was let go as the leader of the university's statewide network of clinics and hospitals by LSU System President William Jenkins. We'll talk with Fred Cerise about health care, one of the big issues permeating in Louisiana and at the state capitol, as lawmakers now are in the home stretch for the 2013 session. What's going to happen with Medicaid, privatization, all this and more with Fred Cerise. Also, we'll hear from New Orleans saxophonist Brad Walker, and we'll get the latest on Governor Jindal's angst about lawmakers at the Capitol. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. We start with our guest for much of the hour today, with Fred Cerise. He was health secretary of the great state of Louisiana from 2004 to 2008. He worked under Governor Kathleen Blanco, leading the largest agency in the state of Louisiana. And one of his predecessors in that job was Governor Bobby Jindal, a man that Secretary Cerise has gotten to know, at least from a policy point of view. What's your take about what's going on regarding health care in Louisiana right now?
Well, I guess the big issue that's being discussed is the Medicaid expansion. There's also the issue what's going on with the public hospital system in Louisiana. And, you know, I think we obviously have different views on the way to approach that than the governor does. I think Louisiana has had a great opportunity to finally cover the entire population. You know, we haven't done that forever in this state, in this country. And with a combination of a Medicaid expansion plus the statewide coordinated public delivery system, we'd have the opportunity to finally have universal access for everyone.
Dr. Cerise has worked at LSU since 1991. He's still on the faculty as an associate professor of medicine. And last year, he was removed from his job leading LSU's statewide network of clinics and hospitals. Was that a political move?
Well, I think, you know, it was a difference of opinion, difference of approach. The governor and consequently LSU's board had a different direction that they wanted to take the public hospitals in. And I fundamentally think that there is a role for that delivery system. There's been a lot invested in that delivery system over time. And based on objective measures of costs and outcomes and those sorts of things, it was an efficient delivery system that took care of a lot of uninsured people in the state. And so, yeah, you know, we did a lot of work trying to establish that was the case. You know, where I miscalculated, frankly, was thinking that those metrics were things that our board was interested in. But there was fundamentally a different opinion on where they wanted to go with that system.
What's your analysis of the closing of Earl K. Long here in Baton Rouge? Is that something that is good or not so good?
Well, you know, the Earl K. Long situation I think every one of our hospitals across the state has got its own unique set of challenges. And Earl K. Long, obviously, we had facility issues that we had to deal with. And the governor made it clear that he was not interested in rebuilding the hospital. And I didn't necessarily disagree with that approach. We did a lot of work to establish that relationship with Our Lady of the Lake, developed it over time, put a lot of thought and effort into that.
You being on this show talking about it.
Correct. And so, you know, as a solution to a facility problem, partnering with the lake, being able to admit those traditional LSU patients in the lake, but then LSU also being able to run its graduate education programs, its outpatient clinics, is not a bad solution. Actually, I think a very good solution for Baton Rouge. We're going to expand services in Baton Rouge and add new services in Baton Rouge.
297-5633, 877-217-5757, wherever you are, for Dr. Fred Cerise. He's been a public servant in Louisiana for over 20 years with LSU since 1991. That's through several governors. How is this governor different from the others?
Well, Yeah, that's an the only governor that I worked directly with was Governor Blanco. I was at Orkay Long when Governor Foster was in place, and you know, I think there was, I suppose the biggest difference I can say with Governor Blanco was that she let us, the cabinet secretaries, do our work, and we brought to her what we thought were the right approaches to some of these issues mm-hmm. that were very complicated, and she trusted us to do that that work. We didn't get into LSU's business at that time. I mean, she obviously had board appointees, but she didn't get deep into LSU's business. This governor obviously gets much more involved in LSU's business and in the operations of the hospital system and other points of LSU's mm-hmm. business as well.
Well, he is a former health secretary, so he knows the terrain pretty well, and I'm sure he has some thoughts that he is making sure that they're carried out. What's your perception about the CNSI fiasco? They're now suing over their contract cancellation. Health secretary has been fired. Bruce Greenstein, as a result, resigned under pressure as a result of his actions. And now it looks like he's being put out there as the guy who was behind this all along. Whether that's true or not, that's what's being said. What do you think?
Well, I don't. I have no firsthand knowledge of Bruce's role in that, what he did, what he didn't do. That's a very high-profile contract, as you can imagine, almost a $200 million contract. So I know what you know from reading the papers about that. I can tell you that, in the discussions around the public hospital system and in Bruce's conversations with the legislature, he was not shy about what I think was misrepresenting the impact and the operations of that public hospital as they pushed an agenda to change that system.
Well, was he doing that on his own? And obviously this is your perception. I'm sure Bruce would have a different point of view, but was he doing it unilaterally, or was he acting on behalf of the administration?
Well, that's a good question that I've not been in those discussions, so I couldn't tell you that.
297-5633. We will go to the phone lines for Dr. Fred Cerise, a passionate man about what he does, and he's been in the healthcare world here in Louisiana, his home state, for his entire career. And we started by a brief mention of the Medicaid expansion. There is now a move in the Senate to try to replicate what's been done in Arkansas. It doesn't look like the governor is going to be receptive to that, but do you think the Medicaid expansion under Obamacare is something that is palatable for the state of Louisiana?
Well, every state is struggling with how do you cover people. The fact is, I'll back up. Do I think that that's the perfect solution? No, but I don't think anybody has the perfect solution because it's such a complicated issue. Do I think that it's a solution that makes sense for Louisiana? Absolutely. We have, depending on whose estimates you look at, 650,000 to 800,000 uninsured people in the state. This is an expansion that would cover 60% or so of those people. And it would do so without an added cost to the state. I mean, we can get into the numbers on that, but I think most people accept and acknowledge that this is not going to, this would not cost the state money to do this expansion. So this decision, I think, is being made for other purposes.
Well, would it cost the state money, or will it cost the state money on the back end if it's not accepted?
Well, that's another good question. I think It depends on how the state approaches its obligation to take care of people. If the state doesn't fund services for the uninsured, then it won't cost the state extra money. But if the state wants to continue to provide services for the uninsured and, mm-hmm. and ensure guarantee access for that population, then you're going to be doing what you do today, and that is you're spending pure state funds mm-hmm. on things like behavioral health and prisoner care. You're spending funds for the uninsured that are matched at a rate of 40% state dollars, 60% federal dollars to take care of an uninsured population, where going forward through this expansion, you'd be covering many of those services with 100% federal dollars. So I think it's fair to say there would be a savings to the state by doing the expansion.
297-5633. We start with Charles on North Foster. Good morning, Charles. You're on the air with Fred Cerise.
Good morning, gentlemen. Dr. Cerise, I met Bobby Jindal when he was secretary, and I asked him about privatizing Earl K. Long. Back then, he said it wasn't fiscally viable. My other question is, when you talk about Earl K. Long, we have an empty woman's hospital less than 10 miles away. How does the state justify handing that hospital to the Lady of the Lake while leaving that empty woman's hospital that could have been used? I'll hang up and listen.
Yeah, the woman's hospital wasn't always empty. And, you know, this discussion about Earl K. Long has been going on for probably 20 years now since I first got to Earl K. Long. And there are a number of starts and stops during that time on looking at various facilities and different solutions. And so remember when this deal was done with Our Lady of the Lake, it's been 3-4 years in the making now, I suppose, probably 3 years in the making. Mm-hmm. That property wasn't available. But there also are other reasons why it does make sense for some of those high-end services to be on site at Our Lady of the Lake. So you'll have access to things like the development of a trauma center. You'll have access to specialty services, cardiac surgery, neurosurgery, those types of things that you just don't have those providers in the end of time town with Earl K. Long. So the idea is maintain those clinic services and as much of that outpatient activity as you can in the neighborhoods, but for those few cases that need highly specialized services, those can be concentrated where you can access those providers.
297-5633 is your number. Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, you're on the air with Fred Cerise. Hi, Phil.
Good morning, Jim. Yes, sir, Mr. Cerise. My question to you is, I've been following the Charity Hospital situation now since the storm, since Katrina, and there's been a very credible study that says for around $400 million that building, which sits empty now to this day and has not moved but an inch since it was built in 1936, could be utilized. Now, I haven't gotten an honest answer as to why it's sitting there and then they're building a facility knocking down the neighborhood surrounding it. It seems to me that how we can infer nothing else but that there's corruption and the good old boy system is alive and well in the governor's house.
Well, you know, that facility had a lot of problems before Katrina. I trained in Charity Hospital, and for many years before Katrina, there was a lot of work went into identifying how to fix it, replace it, and so no doubt you could gut that place and turn it back into a hospital, but the state architects and planners that looked at that determined that it would cost just as much or more to do that than to replace it with a new state-of-the-art facility.
So you're okay with the new facility?
I'm okay with the physical structure.
What about the rest?
Well, you know, I think the operation and the plans there have changed over time as well. We've moved from an agreement that was put in place and the legislature approved that put that the operation under an mm-hmm. LSU-affiliated not-for-profit, a structure that a lot of academic medical centers across the country, state centers, have moved to, where they would affiliate with a private not-for-profit that has a purpose to support the public institution, clearly stated purpose to do that, and it would still operate in the public realm. This original agreement now is being recrafted and restructured to create a private entity that's got an arm's length relationship with the university.
So you're not all that enthused about the privatization efforts from this administration.
Well, from the medical school standpoint, it's important to have a university hospital, and mm-hmm. That hospital is our classroom, and in New Orleans, that's our biggest operation. And so it's critically important that that the school and the hospital operate in lockstep. And, you know, we've migrated away from that original design.
297-5633 is your number outside the area, 877-217-5757, and inkstershow@wrkf.org. We'll resume our conversation with Dr. Fred Cerise. He was Health Secretary of the state of Louisiana from 2004 to 2008 in the administration of Governor Kathleen Babineau Blanco. Back with Fred Cerise after this time out on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633. Dr. Fred Cerise, a man who knows healthcare in Louisiana like few others. He is here to talk about the landscape as we know it today, as lawmakers are continuing to weigh the benefits or the drawbacks to expansion of Medicaid. Do you think that the governor is against this because a Democratic president has put it in action? If it had been a Republican president, would his point of view be different?
I don't know what his opposition is based on. I can only comment on the things that he has said and he has written, and he's written things like, if we move this population onto Medicaid, then we're going to have 41% of the population in Medicaid. We'll have before long more people in the wagon than pulling the wagon. So it appears that his opposition is more mm-hmm. related to shifting more people onto public coverage as opposed to whether it's a Democrat or a Republican that's proposed this.
As a governor, is his health care taken care of?
It's personally, mm-hmm. Of course. I mean, state employees have health care. And this is the thing. You know, we talk about 41.
Is that socialism?
That he's on a public mm-hmm. health plan. There's a lot of people in this state and this country on public health coverage, right? Mm-hmm. If you're over 65,
right.
You're going to have public care. If you're a veteran, you get public care through the VA. If you're a state employee, you're getting that. And so this idea that because Medicaid's a public program, it's something that we ought not take advantage of, I think.
Well, who's pulling the wagon for his health insurance?
That's, I mean, you know, the people who are in this Medicaid program are working people, right? If you look at who is uninsured in the state and the country, 62% of the uninsured in the country have a full-time worker in the house. Another 16% have a part-time worker in the house. So almost 80% of the uninsured have a full or part-time worker in the house. They just can't afford the price of health insurance, which has outpaced wages three times in the past decade. So these are people that are working hard. They just can't afford to pay the full cost of health insurance, which, by the way, the uninsured is not driving that mm-hmm. cost. That's being driven by, as you know, it's a profit-driven industry, and people with insurance are driving that.
297-5633, Inkstershow at WRKF.org. Elise on Perkins asks about the governor's overall philosophy as far as privatization, and she asks if he's doing this from a GOP playbook.
Yes, I can't speak to his motives on privatization. I can tell you what we did when I came back to LSU 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. We made a very strong emphasis on looking at metrics and comparing that system to peers and trying to develop some objective measures, because I could read what the landscape was as well as anyone else, and knew that system was going to be the subject of a lot of challenges. And so we worked very hard to demonstrate that its costs were in line with or very competitive compared to national peers. Its quality was in line. Those are not things that were evaluated in this this move towards privatization. It's not being based mm-hmm. on those objective measures. I can say that much.
You must know Dr. Bill Cassidy, who worked at Earl K. Long for more than 20 years. Probably rubbed shoulders with him in the hall.
I know
nice
Bill
guy,
well.
Nice guy, isn't he?
He is.
But he has a different point of view than you on this, and it may be related in some way to him being a U.S. congressman who is trying to become a U.S. senator. But what's your assessment about how he's looked at the same information as you? And on any number of these issues today, he would probably sit in the other chair and say that he differs in opinion.
Yeah, I think a concern of a lot of people, the Medicaid program is by no means a perfect program, all right? And you can always find something to pick. But you could find something to pick about every component of our healthcare delivery system, right? He's proposed a different approach where you'd actually put some caps in the Medicaid program. He's concerned about how different states have gamed the Medicaid program in terms of, trying to generate additional federal match without putting up your legitimate public funds. We're in the midst of trying to do some of that in Louisiana right now. We're trying to ensure the flow of federal funds, but back out the state funds that we put into the system. So I think he's got some legitimate concerns. We would differ in terms of the solution, because I think right now we've got a lot of uninsured people that need coverage, and this is the solution that the federal government has put on the table for us, and so I think the state ought to take advantage of it.
877-217-5757 for Dr. Fred Cerise Shaw in Capitol Heights. Good morning, Shaw. You're on the air with Dr. Cerise.
Good morning, Dr. Cerise. Earlier you said that cost, you know, the dollars, if they are not allocated for Medicaid, and you mentioned the related cost of prison population, et cetera. Have there been any studies that will illustrate or demonstrate what will happen to the uninsured dollar-wise for the private sectors like Shumpert or Cabrini, when, you know, we know when their care costs are the highest, when they are the sickest, they are going to show up in ER settings.
Well, I think when you look at the impact on the private hospitals of the expansion, it's clear that they would do well. They would do better under the expansion because, as you said, they've got to deal with people who come to the hospital in the emergency room. Some of those people get admitted to the hospital, and under Medicaid expansion, they would have coverage. In fact, in many other states, the hospital associations have been the ones to put out the economic impact studies, the analyses, and have put a lot of pressure on their state governments to accept the expansion.
Harry in Kenilworth. Harry, you're on WRKF with Dr. Fred Cerise.
Yes, sir. I've got just a couple of things that caught in my craw, I guess, as I listened to the conversation. I paid for Social Security and Medicare for 40 years while I was working, and I've been pulling that wagon for 40 years. The wagon has already been pulled. The idea that there may be more people in the wagon that are pulling the wagon is pure fiction. The other thing is that all of the financial projections are just that. They are projections. They're based on theoretical income for the state, and they don't include the coming and obviously coming of advances in technology. I mean, you hear about a cure for all forms of cancer that is effective in mice right now, and within 10 years will be effective in human beings. I told a guy one time when we were inspecting a building for asbestos that, you know, one of these days somebody's going to invent a cure for cancer in it.
All right. Would you respond?
Sure. Well, it's a good example you use with asbestos. I had an example with a cook the other day. You worked for 40 years. You paid into the system. I got a call about someone who's been a cook at a restaurant for 30 years who had a serious problem, was having difficulty swallowing. Turns out that this lady has esophageal cancer. Now, does not have health insurance because as a cook, if you look at the percentage of her salary that she would have to pay to purchase health insurance, she'd be about 50% of her salary. So that's just not going to happen. So it's not a matter of if they've been pulling the wagon. She's been pulling the wagon. She just couldn't afford to have health care. You talked about asbestos. Typical construction worker. Many construction workers are not able to afford health insurance. So if they've worked on that job for many years or exposed to asbestos, they may develop physical health problems because of that. They've certainly pulled the wagon for many years, but because of their type of employment, their employer didn't offer insurance, they don't have the ability to buy insurance. Are we just to tell those people, sorry, you can't take advantage of the medical advances now that we've developed in the country?
What about the lady with esophageal cancer? What does she do if she doesn't have health care?
Well, I mean, this question, see, a lot of people like to talk about this issue who have never sat across an exam table from a patient or been in a hospital room taking care of a patient. And if you talk to the people at Earl K. Long and other places where these are real problems. These are things that they've struggled with every day. So, you know, today what happens is some of those people, if they know how to access public delivery systems, they can get that. Actually, it had been a comprehensive system. Mm-hmm. It's becoming more fragmented now and probably more difficult to navigate across the state. So I would say in many circumstances, that's going to be hit or miss.
297-5633 is your number. There is still time to talk with Dr. Fred Cerise, former Louisiana Health Secretary under Governor Blanco, her only Health Secretary, right?
That's correct. I left when she determined mm-hmm. she wasn't going to run again. I went back to LSU, and so there was someone, Dr. Townsend, filled in for the few months after that.
Now, Governor Jindal is in his second term, so he's had, Alan Levine and Bruce Greenstein. Now, in Arkansas, there was a plan that was a variation of the Obamacare Medicaid approach that was embraced by the federal government, passed by a Republican legislature, signed by a Democratic governor. Senator Ben Nevers was on this show Friday, and he is trying to replicate that in Louisiana. I think the state could opt out in 2017. Is something like that a viable compromise?
Well, that's a question for the governor, and I think his comments have been that it's not. At least the people that represented him at the legislature that day indicated that that was not an acceptable compromise to them.
Albert Samuels, Professor Samuels at Southern University. Good morning. You're on the air with Fred Cerise. Hi, Dr. Samuels.
Hello. How you doing, Jim? Good to talk to you. And good to talk to Dr. Cerise. He's kind of become a hero of mine recently. I had a quick question for you. You mentioned something about some objective metrics that you all have been working on. I guess my question was, are those metrics that you all use and try to talk about the cost structure of the charity hospitals, is that information that's publicly available, or if someone wanted to get more information about it, how could they get more information?
That has been publicly available. We incorporated that into some of our board reports over the years. If that's not in the old minutes, then I can make it available to you, Albert.
All right. Best way to contact you or your staff is?
You can contact me personally at I'll give you Albert, my Gmail account, which is fpcerise@gmail.com.
fpcerise@gmail.com to talk with Dr. Cerise in a different way beyond the discussion today. So, let's say we get through June 6th, lawmakers go home, there's no Medicaid expansion. What happens?
Well, that's a good question. And I think, you know, the changes that are going on with the public delivery system now are just that. They're changes. They're big changes. There's a lot of uncertainty, I think, at this point. We've got to get some approvals from CMS to make some of those deals work, to make sure some of the funding mechanisms that have been proposed are actually allowed. And there'll be some time to have all this sort out and have the dust settle. But, you know, I think we've gone from a situation that has been fairly stable over a number of years, with an opportunity to cover additional people through Medicaid. As I said earlier, you know, there was the groundwork there to have a comprehensive system to cover everyone. I think it's going to be a bit uncertain for the next few years.
297-5633 is your number for Dr. Fred Cerise. Is that Rancy? Rancy in Millerville. Good morning. You're on with Dr. Cerise.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Cerise, I have great admiration for you. I'll start out with that. You said you were involved in the planning of the moving of charity or what was going to happen to it in the future. And I was wondering if in these discussions, moving the services so far from the communities primarily served by charity, was there a concern about moving it so far away from them and our transportation not being up to the ability to move people each?
Yeah, no doubt there were a lot of concerns about that, and there were trade-offs that we looked at in that process. And at the end of the discussion, what we concluded was the access to the additional specialty services for the small number of people that need those very high-end services made it worthwhile to do that change. There was an active group that had been working on transportation issues, working with CATS to ensure that transportation was taken care of. In the past 6 months or so, that process got greatly accelerated. The move date got pushed up. As you know, you may know, it was originally scheduled for November. And so some of the things that were not quite worked through just didn't get completed.
Lauren on Dalrymple, perhaps a neighbor of Dr. Cassidy, wants to know, Dr. Cerise, with Dr. Cassidy running for the U.S. Senate, do you have any aspirations to run for his House seat?
No, I don't.
Well, we've got a doctor in the House in Lafayette, one in Shreveport, one in Baton Rouge. It's not an unusual move these days.
Louisiana has more than most, that's for sure.
Yeah, so you're smiling, but you're not going to do it.
No, I'm not interested in that.
What causes these folks to hear the call of public service at that level to switch gears? Although I see that Dr. Cassidy is still continuing to practice some medicine.
Yeah. Well, look, I think, Dr. Cassidy did... he did public service at Earl K. Long for a number of years, right?
Yeah, he's another one who's been a public servant.
Yeah,
that's
and
what
so
he does.
It's an extension of what he was doing, I think.
And there is nothing wrong with that. But there are members of his party, especially pundits on shows like this, who say that people who work for the government are freeloaders. And if Dr. Cassidy and Governor Jindal and others talk about pulling the wagon, well, the taxpayers have been pulling their wagon for a very long time.
Yeah, I think that there are a lot of people. You looked at that the public delivery system, the group that I know, but also outside of that, there are, as you know, many, many, many competent, dedicated people that have worked for state government, federal government. You couldn't qualify these people as freeloaders. My goodness.
Well, I've worked almost my whole career in the private sector, and I can assure you that the people who work in the private sector and the people who work in the public sector are equally adept at what they do. There is nothing that goes away when somebody gets a job in the public sector and works for the government and gets paid by the taxpayers. But there are those who think otherwise, and most of those who point the fingers are those like Governor Jindal, who is a public servant and has been for almost his entire career. And there's nothing wrong with that. He's served our state with distinction. We'll talk more about it with Fred Cerise, and also hear from New Orleans saxophonist Brad Walker when we return after this brief pause on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Kevin Gallagher producing, and a few more minutes with Dr. Fred Cerise, former Louisiana Health Secretary, now Associate Professor of Medicine at LSU. Doug on Goodwood. Doug, good morning. You're on the air with Dr. Cerise.
Good morning. I came in late to this, so I apologize if you've covered it already, but I wanted to follow up on some things Dr. Cerise has said publicly to the effect that the state could have decided to keep the public hospitals open for another year until the Medicaid expansion kicked in, at which time we would have been able to cover the cost. And the decision that was made to begin closing them was a decision of choice, not of necessity. And I just wanted, if you haven't covered that, I was hoping he could speak to that.
Yeah, I've said that. I think that it was a policy decision to move in this direction. There clearly was a strategy that could have sustained the hospitals and then done the Medicaid expansion and had long-term sustainability of that system. So it was a policy decision to go in the other direction.
297-5633, just a bit more time with Dr. Fred Cerise. Do you agree with that policy position?
No, but I mean, so that's why I'm not doing what I was doing before, too. That's how it works.
Yeah. Well, how is this going to play out over the long term if you've got your crystal ball with you as far as the privatization? Is this going to work?
Well, time will tell. I think, you know, if you look at healthcare in the country, though, we're migrating towards more tiered systems and less. And I think, you know, we've got an expensive system that is pricing many people out of the market, and we don't want everyone to have the same access in the same system. So I think we're going to have this private insurance market that's going to accommodate some, but then others are going to need more public assistance. And I think that the delivery system, where you can put some parameters around what's available and intelligently ration resources, is better than having less structure. And so how this privatization is going to play out, who knows? But I can tell you this. You look around the country, you don't have big health systems that have a strategy direction to fragment. They're consolidating. They're creating scale to control more aspects of the delivery system so they can deliver on costs and outcomes. We're going in the other direction.
Today's top story in the New York Times headline, GOP is readying a new offensive over health law. Election weapon seen. Democrats worry over possible problems in carrying it out as the administration struggles to put in place the final complex piece of President Obama's signature health care law, an endeavor on a scale not seen since Medicare's creation nearly a half century ago. Democrats are worried about major snags in the face of Republican plans to use the law as a weapon in next year's midterm elections. How much of this is political?
Well, there's a lot of it is political, right? I don't think the discussion has ever ended, this debate over Obamacare. Even after it became law, the Supreme Court, when they ruled that states had the option to expand Medicaid, most people, I think, would have looked at that and said, geez, if you look at the deal, it's 100% federally funded, and it tapers off to 10% state contribution over the next 6 years, that states would adopt that. But many states haven't, and it's kept the political discussion alive.
Well, Dr. Cerise, it's good to visit with you. I know you're a busy man, and we'll let you get back to treating your patients, and we'll look forward to another conversation soon. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for visiting with you.
Thank you for your contributions to the great state of Louisiana. 297-5633. In a few moments, we'll hear from remarkable musician, Brad Walker, but did want to note that Governor Jindal yesterday made some noise, called a press conference at the Capitol, and is applying political pressure on lawmakers who worked without his input, he says, on an alternative to his state spending plan. Among the items that lawmakers are weighing as a way to balance the budget, funding tax breaks at 85% of their current value, $106 million in state agency spending cuts, including reductions in Medicaid payments, travel, contracts, and a job training program. And the governor says, we hear Louisiana legislators are cooking up a secret plan to raise taxes by at least $1.3 billion over 4 years with no public input. About as passionate as the governor has been in a long while, here's how he sounded yesterday in his remarks.
You know, it appears there is a plan downstairs. It appears there is a movement amongst some members of the House to adopt a secret plan to raise taxes on Louisiana families and businesses by as much as up to $500 million. And I'm here to say that's wrong. The reality is the public deserves the right to know what's in the plan. They deserve the right to actually have a chance to comment on this plan. That opportunity is in committee. By moving these shell bills out of committee, The legislature, the House committee, is actually denying the people of Louisiana the chance to make their voices heard. And that's wrong, especially when you consider the fact the legislature could be considering later this week the largest tax increase we have seen in this state in decades, literally going all the way back to the 1980s.
Governor Jindal's remarks were countered by those of John Bel Edwards. And by the way, the $500 million figure that the governor used is the one-year figure. Governor Jindal's remarks, as you might expect, were not met with great approval from Representative Edwards, who is running for governor next time around. He says that members are digesting plans details of the plan and have not reached a consensus. And by the way, there are Republicans and Democrats who are working on this plan. And we'll see where it goes. And the governor is using the power of his office and the bully pulpit to make his voice heard that he's not at all enthused about this. And as we know, the budget is in a tenuous state, and lawmakers are attempting to address that. The governor does not like their approach. We'll be talking about that more in the days and weeks to come. Did want to note that yesterday was the funeral for Jerry Lane, the business person of significance in this community for about half a century, and a man who spent his money on not only his people and his businesses, but also put $30 million back into the Louisiana economy through benevolent philanthropic contributions, and quite a man and a fixture in this community for many years, the car dealer Jerry Lane. Overflow crowd at Green Oaks Funeral Home, and we were privileged to talk with Jerry Lane not so long ago on this show. He was discussing the biography written about him by Leo Honeycutt, and here is Jerry Lane commenting a few months before his passing. Your biggest success, what would you say?
Becoming a Chevrolet dealer.
That changed everything.
It did. Well, you know, I work 6 days a week, still do. And I just felt that there was 4,300 and 23 Chevrolet dealers, and I knew that I could do better than a lot of them could. Mm-hmm. And if they could make money, I could make a lot.
Your biggest setback?
Well, I've had some. Probably buy here, pay here was probably one of them. That's where you sell a guy a bad car with a bad credit, and you're going to get it back. But by and large, if I had something that wasn't making money, I just redoubled the effort and worked harder.
Jerry Lane, we'll miss it. In studio is Brad Walker, New Orleans saxophonist, who is a man who is on the move, young guy who is already quite prominent in the music community, and he has just released a new CD from the Brad Walker Quartet. Good morning, Brad.
Jim, nice to see you. Nice
to be here. Who are the other members of the Brad Walker Quartet?
Well, so actually what I gave you is a demo, sort of a pre-production thing. We're doing the full recording in June, and we'll drop the full album in probably October this year. But the musicians on this record will be the great James Singleton, legendary New Orleans bass player, Brian Seeger, another great New Orleans musician, and Simon Lott, Baton Rouge native, that's been active in New Orleans for going on 10 or 12 years now.
And you have 2 degrees from LSU.
I do, actually. Yeah, I did an undergraduate in music performance, saxophone performance with Dr. Griffin Campbell. Finished in 06, spent a few years in New York, and then came back to complete a master's in jazz studies, which I finished in, I think it was 11.
You become quite an authority on the Baton Rouge music scene.
Oh, I don't know about that, but I did get my start here, you know, and I still feel like a Baton Rouge musician. I do live in New Orleans now, and I've transitioned to being primarily a New Orleans musician and primarily working with New Orleans acts, Eric Lindell, Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes, and my own projects. But I still think of myself as a Baton Rouge musician. I still play here fairly often. So.
Last week we heard from the spectacular singer Philip Manuel.
Yeah, I know Philip.
Yeah, and he's as good as anybody in the country, and he performs in Baton Rouge and New Orleans, mostly New Orleans, his hometown. And there's some other hidden jewels. There are a lot of others. We've got people who are in the music business and have been for years in this community who were really unheralded. One of those is your buddy Rusty Yates.
Yeah, right, Rusty. I love Rusty. We work together fairly often, yeah.
Oh. What do you do with Rusty?
Well, we did a record, I guess that came out last year, and I was performing with his band pretty much full time. We did once a month at Sullivan's and did other gigs here and there. Unfortunately, my schedule has prevented me from playing with him recently, but
Rusty is good. He's gotten a lot of passive smoke through the years, though.
Rusty's another one of those Baton Rouge legends, you know. I mean, from I wasn't around, obviously, when he was getting started. But, man, you know, from what I understand, 16-year-old kid playing packed houses in New Orleans, you know, and then left to go make his name in Vegas and is now back and making a go of it. He's got a record that we put out last year that I think is great, and then he's putting out another one, I think, early next year that should also be excellent. So definitely check out Rusty's work.
Eric Lindell, you've worked with him.
I did work with Eric. We actually played Baton Rouge relatively often, once every 3 or 4 months, played at Chelsea's and played downtown.
Now, you got to know Derek Gordon, and we all commend the late, great Derek Gordon for his movement in this area toward more recognition and more people coming this way of significance to perform in our community. With his passing, who's going to pick up the mantle?
That is a good question. That's a, you know, one of the things I wanted to talk about. I do feel like when I got back here in 2009, and actually Derek is a huge part of this, I really feel like there's sort of a new energy and new momentum in the music scene here. You know, I feel like I say we because I still think of myself as a Baton Rouge musician in a lot of ways. I feel like we are on the cusp of sort of moving up a notch, moving to another level in terms of, you know, the cultural capital we have to offer. I mean, Derek had just an unbelievable amount to do with that. In terms of who he brought here, you know, national touring acts, jazz artists that wouldn't have come here if he hadn't specifically set it up, but also in terms of encouraging young musicians like me and other people active in the music scene to continue to develop what we do and present it to the world. So,
what about jazz in Baton Rouge? Is this a good place?
That's a good question. I think that there's a place for jazz here, but I think it's difficult to really establish yourself as a jazz musician here. I think that's why a lot of us that got our start here have either ended up moving to New Orleans. I mentioned Simon Lott, who's on this new record that we're working on in June. Simon's one of the best musicians of his generation to come out of Baton Rouge. I don't think there's any doubt about that. But even when he was living here, he was going to New Orleans 5 or 6 nights a week. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And he's since moved there full time. I've moved there full time. One of my teachers, Mike Esnault, lives and works here, teaches at Baton Rouge High, but performs extensively in New Orleans because there's more of an active community built around that kind of music there.
You've got a show coming up.
We do. We've actually got a tour, and we are kicking it off here in Baton Rouge. I love playing Baton Rouge. It always sort of feels like a homecoming since I've spent so much time here. And we are kicking off our spring tour tomorrow night at a wonderful new venue in downtown Baton Rouge called Mud and Water at 9:30 p.m.
Mud and Water. Location of Mud and Water?
It's on South Boulevard. 174 yeah. South Boulevard.
All right, so you're not far from the main drag.
Right, it's right downtown, part of that new vibrant art scene that has sprung up downtown since I left in 06. The change is pretty striking. And this spot is right near the river, right under the bridge. So,
Brad Walker is the name, one to remember. A young man on the move. And Kevin, let's give a listen to Brad and his quartet. Here, this man can do it. Quite a saxophonist. Who were some of your influences as you were growing up?
You know, it's funny. My parents had about 4 jazz records when I was growing up, but they had 2 that really...
Take 5 being one of them, right?
Well, we did have... Yeah, we had the great Dave Brubeck record. So, all right, we had 5 records. How about that? We had a couple of Miles Davis records. We had Kind of Blue and Cooking, and then we had John Coltrane's Lush Life, and I've probably listened to those records more than anything else I've ever listened to. So,
greatest saxophonist of all time?
Oh man, that's such a crazy question. I mean, I guess my, you know, as a spiritual inspiration, John Coltrane certainly. But you know, man, I love Grover Washington, I love Jan Garbarek, I love all kinds of different guys. So,
and when did you start playing?
I started playing when I was in middle school. I actually started as a clarinet player, as many of us do, and I still play clarinet.
Yeah. Where'd you go to school, Brad?
I grew up in North Carolina, so I went to high school in Hendersonville and then came down here for school. I actually got recruited to do band. You know, I did the marching band my freshman year and all that.
But, and, of course, LSU has some great music professors.
It does, man. I've been very fortunate to have some great mentors. Dr. Grimes and Dr. Deloney there, I've known them for 10 years now, and Dr. Campbell, my saxophone teacher, and more recently, Dr. Brian Shaw, who I met when I got back down here. They've all been great mentors to me, and they're all great musicians.
They've all been on this show, and hopefully they will be again, as will you, Brad Walker. And you can see and hear Brad tomorrow night.
Mud and Water, 9:30 p.m.
on South Boulevard, he says. Mud and Water, that's the name. We'll be back tomorrow. For Kevin Gallagher, I'm Jim Engster. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.